go ahead and unmute. Welcome to the February 2016 edition of the Pre-Hospital Care Research Forum Journal Club. We're glad that you're joining us for the PCRF at UCLA. This journal club is going to be focused on cognitive load theory, and it's based on a paper by Dr. Kristen Frazier and company on cognitive load theory for the design of medical simulations. Bill Robertson, who couldn't join us today from Weber State University, had identified this as a paper that was very interesting, and just as a reminder to all of our listeners, please send us the research that you think we should be talking about and participate in these journal club discussions, because we do this with our users, with our members. We're not picking these papers out necessarily all by ourselves. So it's a pleasure to talk a little bit about Dr. Frazier's work, and I'll frame it up a bit on the line as well as Megan Corey. And Megan, do you want to introduce yourself?
Sure. I'm Megan Corey from, Program Director for the Paramedic Program at City College of San Francisco. And perfect. I'm on the Board of Advisors for PCRF.
Excellent. And we'll introduce panelists as we go along. So Keith, I'll ask you to hold tight, and then we'll introduce you a little bit later. The paper is a very recent paper in the Journal of Simulation Healthcare. And it, unlike many of the journal club articles that we do, is not an original paper, meaning it wasn't there wasn't an investigatory purpose. It's a more of a review article and less of less original research. It simply is a good introduction to the concept of cognitive load theory that Bill Robertson felt we really needed in EMS and EMS education. So I'm going to try and summarize a bit of how this article is structured. It has some kind of generalized theory portions of it that explain what cognitive load theory is. And for those of you who've never heard of this concept, it's an adult learning or just a learning theory that's founded on the fact that working memory has a limited capacity and in assimilating new information or novel information, and that we need to move information from this working memory into more long-term memory, and structuring learning activities, particularly in this case simulation in healthcare, in such a way that we can maximize but not overwhelm the working memory can actually mean better performance in the end. So the concept is similar to scaffolding, and it's very compatible with learning theories like Kolb's cycle of experiential learning, in which people are exposed to a stimulus, then they think about it. So you sort of perform and think, and you analyze, and then you go back and review, and it's a cycle of learning. And both of these theories sort of fit together on how simulation-based training and simulation-based training techniques can be more effective if you don't overload one of those systems. So the best way to describe this, if you want an example, is maybe if we're going to train EMTs and paramedics to deal with a cardiac arrest, particularly a pediatric arrest, you would want to start with just the act of doing compressions and maybe what it's like to do it on a little mannequin and get those steps down before you add, for example, BVM, and then add the concept of perhaps starting an IV, giving medications, so is that something you can do, or applying an AED, and then you add, for example, an external stimulus, like a mother who's upset about her son or daughter dying, and then you would add another external stimulus, which might be that the baby is not necessarily in an environment that is a well-lit room, you know, like a classroom, and that you pretty much are scaffolding, if you will, or creating a framework for which the individual can understand these different actions that they're supposed to perform and practice them in a safe environment, but always kind of pushing the envelope of what the working memory is able to assimilate, put into long-term memory, which is an unlimited kind of database or data bank, if you will. That's the hard drive, if we're going to compare this to a computer science kind of concept, where maybe on your desktop you have a limited ability to have all of your computer applications open and all of the information that's stored in your hard drive, but you have a certain amount of stuff that you're working with at any given time. And the human brain is amazing, so it can have these large amounts of information in its hard drive and its long-term memory, and very quickly access them. And if you chunk that information up in such a way that it's easily retrievable, then it can be retrieved very quickly. So the student that learns how to do back valve mask ventilations and learns that skill very well can then notice in the middle of a simulation that back valve mask ventilations are needed, and they just recall that information up and perform that skill, and it doesn't tax the working memory because it's able to call it up from the, if you will, the hard drive or the long-term memory. So the article discusses kind of how those things are organized and a little bit about its use in simulation in general. And part of that is measurement of that internal versus external or intrinsic versus extraneous cognitive load, and discusses sort of that sort of sweet spot. If it's really boring and we're not taxing the cognitive load at all, the working memory at all, then people are bored and they don't want to learn anything. But if there's too much stimulus and too much information to remember, then we're not going to learn anything either, or we're going to learn less. We know from our other studies that we can only remember maybe 7 or so new things at any given time, and so the idea is to get those 7 or as fewer learned and moved into long-term memory before we add more stimulus. You think of the sort of deer in the headlights look is the way I think of this. If the first thing you did in an EMT class is get out of an ambulance and try and take care of a patient that was in a ditch with, you know, 40 below weather here, since we're doing this podcast in Minnesota, it makes me think of that. Megan, you're probably nice and warm, but the concept is that you would need to chunk up the learning, but keep adding to this cognitive load until you can kind of do a full simulation. And then if you're dealing with continuing education and people who have a lot of other experience, they're going to be more challenged, or at least engaged learners, if the simulation is more difficult. They also discuss something that I find amazing, and in a minute I'm going to ask Megan to comment a little bit more about that, but there are studies that used EEG measures,
yeah,
and others that used cortisol levels. So they swab the inside of somebody's mouth and to get a saliva sample to talk about what happens when you're in a full-on simulation in which you're immersed, your whole body's immersed, and you have stress, which is very handy for memory. It really helps memory. So you want to create quote-unquote stressful environments within the confines of some sort of feeling of safety so that learners don't feel the learning environment is broken down and they go into a fight or flight system that shuts down learning and goes into survival mode. So at some point or another, you know, stress and fear, and I hope Bill Toon will kind of address this in maybe one of his comments in a little bit as well, is the concept of pushing the envelope on some of that stress so that impression, that fear or challenge becomes a motivator and a stronger, more indelible mark on memory. So motivation is really just all about emotion and about balancing the emotion of something new and being afraid of something new, or with the ability to integrate it in something that we already know. So sort of a bit of trying to get a Bloom's taxonomy of learning. If we're trying to get it analysis, synthesis, finding different things into critical thinking, we have to move past the memorization and task training that sometimes occurs with just simple repetition of one individual task and then combine it into a larger, bigger picture. So the article also has a really nice table that is cognitive load principles and instructional design recommendations. And it sort of references the related theories of frameworks and talks about how sometimes segmenting or pre-training, so what would happen if you gave a video of a particular skill or watched a video of an actual patient care interaction in the field before you actually try it. Some people have called these even triple jumps, where you try it a little bit in a classroom, but then you're allowed to go back and think about what you did, maybe evaluate your own performance, maybe watch yourself on video if it's fancy, notice what you need to do differently, and then come back and do it again and do the simulation again, see if you can improve. Along the way, you know, people have discussed how debriefings can help identify particular key points that can again go into the long-term memory, and all of these things build on each other. There's a nice little section on briefings and managing the emotion of the participants that are about to undertake the simulation, and then trying to find the appropriate amount of maybe stimulus and distractions, mothers crying if we're talking about the baby in cardiac arrest example, with a need for understanding what the rhythm is and what the maybe the EKG interpretation and the actions that need to go with it. And finally, managing the emotion after the debriefing with proper processing. I think a lot of times in EMS we debrief and we pre-train and debrief more than we actually do the simulation, which, you know, of course is helpful, but sometimes it's the individual themselves that have to process this. So allowing them to manage their own cognitive load and say, I need more information, I need less information, we just keep giving them more and more information that they're not ready to receive. So that stress, I think, is really a key component of what our discussion will focus on today. And I just love that they're using salivary alpha amylase even as a biomarker of stress. And I love that our listeners are chiming in and popping these comments in to help me make sure we're talking about the right things. The final part of the paper is just kind of what connections does this have to simple things that we've known a lot about, like creating some ground rules for simulation so that the rules are always the same. You don't have to wonder, is today a day that I'm supposed to check the vital signs, but the next day I'm just supposed to verbalize them, that some of those rules of engagement are set up and that they can that doesn't take away from the learning, so that we can have our attention focused on the next performance or the next piece of what it is that we want them to incorporate, and the use of multimedia, of course, speech, image, you know, our auditory senses, our visual senses, our motor learning is much more powerful than any of the words we use. So that helps cement some of that learning and is important to combine into those things. And last but not least, there's a nice graphic in this particular article that I think the authors did a fantastic job of explaining, so that we see how sensory memory, so a visual, auditory, tactile kind of stimulus, works its way into the working memory, and then eventually processes and goes to long-term memory. With that, I'll open it up to some comments from Megan Corey and Keith Minoski, Bill Toon. So why don't Corey, do you want to, Megan, sure. Do you want to say something?
Yeah, sure. One of the things I wanted to say is I've reading through this, it's very heavy on jargon, so that can be a little bit of a cognitive load in and of itself. You've been out of your graduate program for a little while. But I think they do a good job of, within the context of all the jargon, providing some relevant examples or ways to explain each of the elements. And, you know, something you were saying about the intrinsic versus extraneous kind of cognitive loads, meaning what we do in the context of the scenario versus what we add, you know, kind of the format of instruction and then these other extraneous things that we can add in, like the, you know, hysterical parent or whatever. I think there's more detail within the intrinsic as well, meaning that we, as we develop simulation, I think most people out there who are educators know this, you know, you start with, like you said, you know, the quality of CPR and the fundamentals of doing the skill itself, and then you progress gradually. And let's say, for example, you're doing a simulation where there, it involves a symptomatic bradycardia patient. And then maybe originally you do something that's very straightforward, that's very related to rate. And then later on, as the student, you know, progresses through, you add a simulation where, you have a bradycardia that is unrelated to a cardiac or an ACLS algorithm, but is caused by something else, and have them draw from other material that they've learned in that interim. So I think there's a lot of good detail in there and a lot of good examples of how we can use this theory to not only apply and design medical simulation, but also study and apply research. And in that vein, I want to get to what you were talking about measuring. So if we're going to use, assuming we're going to use this cognitive load theory at times to design medical simulation, they mentioned that there's a whole section on measuring cognitive load. And although I'm a big fan of physiology and physiologic outcomes, I'm warm on the idea of using physiologic outcomes as surrogate markers for cognitive load, simply because I don't think we... Like you said, stress good? Is, you know, is it a good thing? Is it enhancing in some and not in others? And I think the to just leap to saying, well, we know that stress is okay for, you know, memory, and it's really only laying down long-term memory, but not memory retrieval from, you know, being able to pull up things. And we know that that's the deer in the headlights kind of look. But using it, you know, all these different measures of EEGs and pupil dilation and functional MRIs and eye tracking and salivary cortisol and all of that kind of stuff is interesting and everything. But, you know, at the end of that whole section, they do say, well, ideally we'd like to measure cognitive load in addition to learning outcomes. And that's where my big giant comment is yes, but what are those? You know, what are learning outcomes? The other thing that kind of came to mind as I'm reading this is the whole discussion that we have ad nauseum about the, you know, do we need experience before going, does an EMT need experience before going to paramedic school to be more successful? You know, on the one hand, we see people that say, or we hear people say that, look, there's research that says there's no difference. And yet, you know, from a research perspective, the outcomes we're looking at is success on National Registry, which, you know, I would argue probably is not the best measure of the importance of experience, or if it is important. So there are a lot of issues that I think came up as we're looking at all of these. It's definitely an interesting, it's a great learning tool, this article itself. And actually, I thought also it would be great to have as an internal journal club or whatever, not even that, a faculty retreat. Discussion, you know, internally to go through some of these concepts and then talk about how it should affect our design of medical simulation and maybe even, you know, generate some action research among a few faculty members designed to address a particular problem they're seeing in the classroom repeatedly or in the simulation lab.
I think that's great. It is all about, I think, train like you're going to fight, right? Eventually, we need to get that learner to actually take care of a patient like they would in the field and not just pass the national registry. Hopefully the national registry is to a more scenario-based environment. It gets more realistic, but it'll never be like the real thing. So we have to keep adding and adding and adding, and that's the concept behind the Committee on Accreditation, requiring, you know, actual field experience as a team leader, as a capstone event. You know, you have to see people in the environment actually doing the tasks that we needed. I'm going to go to Keith Manosky next, but there is a comment from Sahej just about the authors advocating revealing the diagnosis of the simulated patient to the students before they begin. And so, of course, is that beneficial or is that not beneficial is Sahej's question, and I think it has to do with at what point in the introduction to the topic slash into the, you know, skill level of the provider are we in. So if we're introducing the concept of diabetes and it's good for them to look up what it is that a diabetic is or does and how to treat them, then I think revealing that it's going to be a diabetic is the exact thing we need to do. And then obviously further along in a more, you know, advanced state, a summative state, even a state of continuing education, you know, revealing the diagnosis is A, not actually real. It's you know, the patient doesn't tell you what's wrong with them, and B, it makes it for the simulation to be so boring that it doesn't even tax the working memory, so therefore you're just bored at continuing education, you don't want to participate because there's no motivation to. So I think there's that sort of, again, scaffolding, building, chunking of information and creating the stress that's, you know, real. And Sahej's comment is, I guess, you know, we don't train like we're going to fight is the seeming discrepancy with the way that sometimes simulation is occurring.
David, Keith, I think that's what I was building on your scenario, starting with, and I don't think that they flat out advocated for it. I think that they mentioned it as a means of reducing cognitive load if you felt that the load was impairing learning. So if you get to a point where you feel like they're a deer in the headlights, you back up and or you start with those kinds of things, those component-based. We covered respiratory, now we do respiratory. And then later, you're building that into it, an all-out scenario where they don't know what they're going into, and there's a little bit more of a load.
Keith, do you have some concepts? There's some other comments coming in from Jeff Anderson and a couple of other listeners, but what's your thought on this?
Thank you very much, Dave. First, let me begin by saying that I truly commend you guys for selecting this particular article. I think it's extraordinarily informative and very, very germane to the paramedic education process, particularly with the advent of the paramedic psychomotor competency portfolios that the National Registry and NIMC are promoting. In reading this particular article, I actually got a lot from it. I really did. It opened my eyes to the difficulties that we traditionally face in training, particularly ALS providers, paramedics, in the simulation labs. And it kind of speaks very strongly, I believe, to the educational process that we have kind of embraced in paramedic education over the years. For example, I think that the paramedic education has been largely motivated to develop entry competent paramedics in a 10 to 12 month period. And this probably results from, you know, industry pressures and tradition and so forth. But when you really consider the scaffolding needs in order to produce a entry level paramedic that's competent, it really requires a lot of foundation and progressive scaffolding that I think would necessitate a much longer educational process than simply a 9 or 10 month program. I know that for my own personal experiences that we try to adhere closely to the concepts of enabling students to gain the skill sets that are necessary that they can invoke them in a scenario, But the reality is that this is a very complex process, and it takes a lot of time, and it really requires a lot of commitment to the student in the laboratory setting. There's so much that this article raises questions to in the manner with which we train paramedics that I echo Megan's comments at the end about developing a forum or a discussion seminar or something that we could investigate this so that we can improve our own education processes within the profession of EMS.
I think you're so right. It's sometimes all about sink or swim with us, and we have such a short period of time to do things in that I think sometimes our sink or swim can be completely overwhelming. I'll play devil's advocate, and probably students of mine who are listening, graduates that either endured my terrible teaching or endured my terrible bad behavior of being histrionic and loud to make sure that people became very motivated, was a bit of kind of sending the message to the student that this some of this scaffolding and some of this activity needs to happen outside of the time that they're in class with an expert, running a good simulation. Otherwise, we won't ever get to the point where we're actually reaching anything that resembles reality. That if we keep iterating on task trainers and try and do this in a stepwise progression that doesn't involve a learner kind of going off on their own and getting some of these things moved from your working memory to your long-term memory, we couldn't get to where we need to be. We have too high of a bar, too much of a, the stakes are too high, that this is emergency medicine, people are going to be very sick, and you need to be able to perform some of these procedures while people are screaming, or there's any number of noise and visual and environmental problems. And by the way, I'm just being a bad host. Keith, can you tell us where you're from, where you're teaching, what are your credentials, so that people that don't know you can know?
Sure. I currently am the program director for the EMS Paramedicine Program at Central Washington University in Washington State, and the chair-elect for the Department of Nutrition, Exercise, and Health Sciences. I've been involved in EMS, unfortunately, for somewhere around 45 years.
Wait a minute, unfortunately. Yeah.
Well, 45 years is a long time to spend in one profession, but I
don't care about what your knees are doing or what your back is doing. We want your brain.
Well, that's probably suffering more than my back at this stage. It has been a pleasure, and what you guys are doing with the pre-hospital care research forum is extraordinary, by the way.
Oh, thank you. Well, we actually told Keith to say that, and then we pay him money when was that?
Not nearly enough, I might
add. We can mute you if you get too nice. Okay, so here's the next person we wanted to just make sure is Dr. Toon is with us. Bill Toon, can you introduce yourself and then tell us you're actively sharing comments on the chat board, and you've got a microphone, so we want to give you the mic.
Very kind of you, Dave. Now I can take over, except you can mute me quickly. So I thought, everyone else.
Wait. Introduce yourself. Who are you anyway?
Well, you know who I am. My name is Bill Toon, and I am the program director of the Loudoun County Department of Fire Rescue and Emergency Services accredited paramedic program. And I also have been in EMS for 41 years now, and a good at least half of that in EMS education, and happy to do that. And I have a doctorate in education, in higher education administration specifically. So now I'll get back to talking about it.
Awesome.
I find that I think it was an excellent article, and I think, again, it shows the importance for us to look to many different journals for answers to those probing questions that we have in our mind. We probably sat and thought, well, what is the best way to do a simulation to maximize the learning? And I love, Dave, when you talked about scaffolding, because I think there's a clear role for that, because I often seen that mistake made where people do not build people up to be able to handle the situation. And then they, as you said, get the deer in the headlights, and is there any learning going on, or are they so stressed out? Now, the reason I was interested in the stressed factors, though, is because some of us, like I'm involved in continuing education a great deal, it would be interesting when we create scenarios is how well can this scenario replicate the potential of what goes on in the field, and also gives them the ability to be in that stressful environment. And it has to be a realistic stressful environment. Sometimes people create these things that happen maybe once in someone's lifetime, and you know, most people would fail that. So I'm interested in what's a realistic stress thing. Where I found things such as looking at amylase or any of these other tools is that it would be interesting that when you take a group of experienced providers and you put them through this scenario, and at some point during the scenario you can measure it to what their stress load is, to find out if you're really pushing the experienced provider versus the new provider. And I first learned about this at the Society of Academic Emergency Medicine's annual meeting when there was a poster presentation on this salivary amylase, where they were looking at it. And the interesting thing, the next step was actually to do it with a code team during an actual resuscitation to measure the stress that was in an actual patient care and see what its measurements were, so we could compare it back against what is in a simulated code situation. And I don't know where he is in his research there, but again, it would be very interesting to see that versus new providers versus old providers. And I'm not saying that we do that daily in our classroom, that kind of stuff. That's where the research would guide us towards how do we construct these kinds of environments. Because the ultimate test is when we're actually taking care of a patient in someone's home. And that is the ultimate one that we're trying to prepare our people for. So again, just a very interesting article. I believe that there's much more science out there that we need to find a way to expose ourselves to, and find ways to use it to improve. As you said, Summit could take place with lots of learned people trying to get together and do it. But what we have to do is we have to create, I still think, something that gets out to the frontline instructors, the people who do it day in and day out, and how they can utilize this to build really good learning scenarios for their students.
Yeah, and I want to encourage and kind of give a shout out to the folks that are doing simulation in healthcare. There's an entire society for simulation in healthcare, and lots of people who are trying to really kind of learn more about how to do that. I'm going to throw out the notion that perhaps we haven't really understood, you know, a lot of this salivary amylase, but also cortisol levels and just other physiological signs of stress. We haven't really understood if that maybe would accelerate some of the theory here about working memory. You know, if our life is in danger, or we are iterating at faster than we think we can, I think there's times that a soldier in battle figures out that if they poke their head too far out of the foxhole, they're going to get themselves killed, and iterate quicker because they're emotionally their sensors, their sensory input is so heightened that, you know, we're learning much, much faster. And I guess I want to encourage people who are doing simulation, and hopefully some listeners who might do some simulation research. I'll give a shout out to the Santa Fe Community College paramedic students there who are our future, and hopefully they'll do some great research about this. But if in fact our heartbeat is going a mile a minute and we are keeping up with it, we're learning a lot quicker because our brain is able to process a lot quicker because we're more alert and we're more invested. And I'm thinking about that sink or swim kind of concept in which, you know, there's some sense of safety. There's some sense that, you know, you're not 100% overturned, overwhelmed, and cannot, you know, recover. But if it's just slightly out of control, you know, my kids are learning how to snowboard, and they're much more efficient, effective at learning how to snowboard when they're on that hill and they're going just slightly faster than what they think they could handle. Now, obviously, they're developing skills as they go, so we don't need to start with the, you know, huge downhill, but they need to be kind of progressively in a moment where they're just seeing that. And this is where I think that simulation needs humans, not necessarily just plastic mannequins and pre-programmed scenarios. Because if you're in the simulation, and please chime in here, educators, I can see that a student is just bored. They're just kind of, they're not challenged. And I can easily increase the difficulty of the scenario by simply, you know, having symptoms pop up or have the symptoms go away, or have an insert into the event that causes the environment to change. But I can't easily go back in and program the simulator to do that. I have to be the one that says, I'm going to hit the button and lose the pulse. I'm going to hit the button and, you know, and suddenly have the family member, you know, whisper into the family member ear that they produce a DNR, because I'm watching that in a very, very fluid situation that's highly dependent on the individual. Do you agree?
Yeah, I completely agree about the use of live patients as well. I think that the simulators are very good for certain things, and then when it comes to other things. Also, I would encourage, I've done this once, and it's terrifying. I've had the students who are getting ready to graduate run a simulation where a few of us faculty or design a simulation, and we run it with this mannequin, and it's very different. Maybe that's something to do with having run so many real patients, but it really gave me a better understanding of what the students are going through. You know, David, I was also wondering what Kim McKenna would think of this cognitive load theory, since she, you know, at some point in this article, they discuss the other mechanisms for learning that they call unrelated to cognitive load, but I would argue that they probably have an effect on cognitive load, and that is things like motivation and reflection. Like, and in the area of reflection, there's things like self-evaluation, and then what about peer evaluation? We're encouraging peer evaluation. Can things like self-evaluation and peer evaluation encourage a safer learning environment, getting to that whole, you know, psychological effect of simulation, and then thereby reduce cognitive load that may have been something, you know, higher for that same student early on, but as they get used to being accustomed to making mistakes, that it's okay to make mistakes, that it's actually encouraged to make mistakes, and they feel a safe learning environment, they reflect on their own learning, they peer evaluate, then can they take a higher, you know, stimulation, more extraneous kind of factors, and therefore, you know, the load itself becomes lower and enhances learning.
I think, you know, I think you're dead on here, and when you're in the flow of this, when things are really in the groove, a very tiny signal, and I do mean a signal, like, it doesn't necessarily need to be an auditory confirmation from a peer that says, good job, keep going, you got it right. It can be something as simple, you know, and as intangible as just the way that they looked at you, the way that they, you know, they proceeded to the next thing, that a team is sort of confirming things are moving in the right direction, reduces your cognitive load. You start thinking, oh, okay, wow, whereas somebody who jumps in and says, no, I completely disagree, you're absolutely wrong, that's not what we should do, would increase your cognitive load, and you'd go, oh my goodness, I'm making a mistake, and how do I recover from that? And having five people on your team all telling you that you need to do it differently, and all of them arguing, would skyrocket your cognitive load. So it is the feedback mechanisms midstream in the simulation. We sometimes try and, I think in education, just make a straight cut ditch out of a free meandering brook. And Henry David Thoreau said that in fact we try and clean it all up for them, but simulation is where it gets meandering again and it gets complex again, and the concept that just the person that's the instructor gives feedback is completely flawed. There's a bunch of people on the line that actually are experts at this. Mark Malonzo at UCLA is doing a PhD on many of these, and he's asking, should the stressors that increase extraneous load be incorporated early on or after students get more accustomed to the simulations? And that's what we're all talking about, right? Keith, you had a comment as well. Come back to us. Go ahead.
Thank you. Yeah, this is very timely, I think, because I was considering the elements of this article, and they put some emphasis, I think most correctly, on the detriment of extraneous cognitive load. But when you think about the education process that we go through as paramedics and we train our paramedics, there's a lot of that. There really are. If you think about the process, you know, they're taught skills and they're to integrate those skills and they're introduced to a scenario. And as you progress through the scenario, they're asked more and more complex questions and presented with more challenges. Our goal in education has long been to help them become critical thinkers, to help them in problem solving, to help them to be exposed to emotional stressful situations. Yet all these things, I think, according to this article anyway, are considered extraneous cognitive loads that's going to be a detriment to their learning process. I think back on some of the cases, for example, where we present a scenario to a group of students whereby the patient's outcome is going to be a undesirable negative outcome regardless of what the student does, like a cardiogenic shock patient, for example, and the student does all the right things, yet the patient dies. And that simulated patient death has obviously an emotional impact on that particular student's learning experience.
Ooh, I'm glad you brought that up. That's a pet peeve of mine. Like, if you do everything right, the patient lives. If you mess up, the patient dies. Sets up the dynamic that when people get out there and a patient dies, they think they did something wrong when they could have done everything absolutely perfectly, and it was just that, you know, our resuscitation was not successful. So we have to be able to train like we're going to fight and simulate our battlefield conditions so they don't feel like, well, you know, now that the patient died, I must have made an error, and that's the cause. I just want to throw out there for everybody, Bill Leggio is listening with his class at Creighton University, so thank you for joining us. And he just participated in the research summit and had me walk into the room multiple times asking him as he was thinking about the research they wanted to do, quote, so what? So what? So what? We understand this cognitive load theory to be a theory of how we move information from working memory into long-term memory and how we can kind of apply it to other things, and so what? But I think Dr. Leggio is throwing out more of a challenge just to be a little bit of a rebel rouser than he actually really believes, because I think, like you've already mentioned, we've been discussing why it is so important to be able to understand and be more than casually acquainted with the theory of how people learn, so that when we apply these things in the middle of a simulation, we're in complete command, and not maybe complete command, but at least have a better understanding of, you know, we've just overtaxed a student and we need to back away. And the instructor who's good at this is just intuitively looking at their students going, okay, stop. We're lost. We don't know what we're doing. Let's refocus. And I think we're never taught this theory. We don't know how to really use it effectively, and we're not very methodical about pre-training and scaffolding and bringing in those things that could accelerate some learning, right? It could potentiate some of our conceptual frameworks to actually have a practical application. Do you agree?
Well, David, I have to say, too, it starts a discussion with your own faculty members as well as your preceptors about thinking about the way students learn and about thinking about how we help them learn. The other thing that comes up is you know, I appreciate that he brought up zone of proximal development and scaffolding and all the, you know, educational theories, because not only does that apply to your class of students, they apply to your individual students. So each student's going to have a different comfort zone, you know, where they come in with things that they already know, versus the area where you have to kind of, where they'll learn with some guidance, versus the area that's the anxiety zone, where they're just, it's just beyond their learning. But each one of them is a little different there too. So I think that's important for faculty to know, so it's not, maybe help scaffold our own internal education of our faculty and helping them think about how to be that facilitator in that middle zone of proximal development, rather than just the sink or swim, sorry, you're just not cut out for this kid kind of a faculty member. And to keep them from designing simulations that are based on the call they had last night, which we know.
Yeah, just coming up with, oh, well, let me try this, because we didn't think of this through. And that goes to Bruce Nippon's comment, who is master educator, author of a field training text, and he had a microphone. He says, do stressors have the have to be specific to the simulation, or do the stressors have, you know, of any kind have the same result? And of course, you know, in the article, I think they really do address that well, and that is just the extrinsic kind of load, if it's really just annoying and useless, has no real benefit of learning if it's not pointed. But, you know, let me just introduce the notion, as we were calibrating scenarios for some of these registry portfolio scenarios, we introduced the notion that, you know, during a simulation that the phone would ring and that the, you know, family member would be having some information, and if they answered the phone, they'd have to interact with that family member and demonstrate affect and yada yada. Well, the concept of just making noise, taking a pot and a pan and clanging it together, would similarly increase the noise level, but it does not have the same cognitive effect as the complexity of, do I answer the phone? Is the information that the family member going to give me helpful to me right now? Do I postpone that? What if I can't call the person back? What if they, you know, can help me in some way? And so I would say, to answer Bruce's question, it's dead on. Those stressors have to be planned, incredibly accurate, and that's what the article really refers to. Is if the simulation mannequin has a broken IV arm and a broken pulse motor, so that the pulse is not felt and the arm isn't really actually available to start an IV, then it's increased extrinsic noise. It's just useless, and it's a detriment to the system, rather than adding a layer of, okay, there's some extra noise, but the noise is a symphony of, you know, particular pieces that help move the learner in the right direction. I can think of many of my teachers that were great at making me feel like I was either fantastic or terrible, but never taught me anything. So they told me great stories, or they helped me do simulations where I thought, you know, oh great, I felt great about this simulation, but I didn't really, you know, improve in any way, and vice versa. You know, I can, you know, tell you I've been humiliated in the middle of a scenario, but it didn't teach me anything. It was just more about humiliating a person versus saying, okay, this is an error, this is a failure, how do we come back and retool that, right? So the stressor is absolutely at the core of how that load gets managed.
I think we're all just trying to process, you know, the same way that we did test item design with written tests, with knowledge application and problem solving levels of difficulty, trying to kind of do the same thing with simulation. And I know, David, you talk about skill versus scenario versus simulation, which I think is an important distinction, but there probably that needs some discussion about, you know, standards of practice for creating levels of simulation as well.
Yeah, those are I think key distinctions, and we don't have any language right now. People get all messed up with what's a formative, what's a summative kind of moment, what's a simulation versus a scenario, and we haven't defined that in our field well enough to know that. We're approaching the bewitching hour, and we're going to lose a bunch of folks that have classrooms full of students, which is such a pleasure to hear, and I'm so glad that you guys tune in, and I hope those students become the next wave of researchers and comment on these podcasts. We should be able to get them a microphone so that they can say something. But your last words, Keith, Biltoon, Megan?
Yeah, this is Keith. I just have one final comment that I wanted to share with everyone. And we're beginning to start a process in interprofessional education with our students across institutions. We have a couple medical schools, physician's assistant schools, nursing schools, and so forth. And we're introducing our students to cooperative education with interprofessional studies and practice. So I think this does speak well to the team approach and reducing cognitive load by a team effect.
Love it. Bill, any words of wisdom?
I have plenty of words. I'm not sure how wise they might be. I'm going to throw out there that, you know, the complexity, maybe what we're trying to do needs to be built over a longer period of time to truly develop practitioners, competent practitioners. You know, I often look at other forms of healthcare education, and I wonder why we expect so much out of paramedics, but we do not develop them the same way that other health professions do. And I sometimes wonder if we are trying to meet a demand from fire chiefs, ambulance service owners, whatever it might be, versus the most important demand, and that's putting people out that really understand how to take care of patients. And to do that well, I think it takes time. And we as educators learning things about cognitive load is just a step in that direction, that I think more time is necessary and not less.
Great comments. Megan?
Well, I think they said it all. I think that's, I completely agree.
Yeah, me too. Well, what a wonderful discussion, and I hope people listening actually thought that as well. But we'll continue down this investigation. Next month, we have a paper on violence and violence particularly experienced by EMS providers, a topic that's clearly a hot topic. So Monday, March 14th, 2016 at noon Central, please join us. And if you have other journal articles, other original research, maybe you have commentary, you want to be able to hook up your microphone. Mark Malonzo says goodbye, in fact, and says he'll find a microphone next time so he can quote him more Dr. Sweller's stuff. It's fantastic, and thank you for joining us.